It's all about the vaccine haves versus the have-nots. With COVID, wealthier countries are hanging onto vaccines they may never use.
We have already headed into a kind of COVID-19 vaccine apartheid with very dramatic consequences.
Also today in Mexico, some healthcare workers say they're waiting for their shot, but they're being skipped over.
Today, I am angry. I'm no longer sad. Today, I'm angry.
And in France, a court decides not to prosecute a murder, sending thousands of people to the streets in protest and in shock.
So someone can just smoke a joint and then go and kill someone?
Also, an international team nabs the Oscar for Best Sound Design for a story about people who can't hear. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you with us this Monday. Help is heading to India. After much pressure, the Biden administration is allowing shipments of some raw materials for the manufacture of COVID-19 vaccines. The White House is also sending test kits, ventilators, and personal protective gear. This marks an abrupt shift for the U.S., and for India, the news couldn't come soon enough, as they struggle with an outbreak that is pushing its healthcare system to the brink. Matt Cavanaugh, an assistant professor of global health at Georgetown University, gets us going with our coverage today. Explain why the White House is now going to go ahead and loosen restrictions on these raw materials to make vaccines, Matt.
India is in a full-blown crisis right now, and we're seeing that not just India, but also Nepal and various other countries in the region are seeing such remarkable spiking cases of coronavirus that we just have to act. And so they're beginning to allow a certain set of materials to be shared with Indian manufacturers so that they can make vaccines to serve the Indian market and to serve the region.
So I don't know if you would have called this a ban on exporting these materials, but what was the legislation and mechanism that imposed this?
So this is the Defense Production Act. It's a 1950s law that dates back to the Korean War. And what it does is it allows the president to order certain companies to prioritize certain orders, right? So vaccine orders from companies making things that are needed for vaccines, the orders have gone that those have to go first to vaccine manufacturers here in the United States, and even ahead of other things, right? So companies that might have been making, you know, vitamins now have to focus on providing those same technologies or those same products to vaccine manufacturers here in the U.S. And sometimes you have to get permission ahead of time to actually export those goods.
So explain what these raw materials are exactly. What is their role for COVID vaccines?
So we don't know exactly which raw materials we're talking about that the Biden administration's decided to share with the rest of the world right now because they haven't publicized that. But the Serum Institute in India has talked about some of the elements that they're missing. It includes things like giant sterile bioreactor bags, right, that are made, you know, required to produce a bunch of the vaccines, certain chemicals that are needed in the production, certain specialized filters. And these are highly specialized pieces that you can only get in a handful of places. So there's companies in the United States and also in Europe and a couple other places that make these very specialized pieces. And everybody has been saying, look, we need to prioritize these into vaccine manufacturing. But because they're not made in India, Indian companies have to import them. And so when the United States says they have to go first to Pfizer or first to Moderna, they can't then also go to the Serum Institute. And so that's been the permission that's been lacking.
So where would India have been getting these materials from otherwise? I mean, and is this part of the cause of the spike in India?
So India has been ordering from a global supply chain. And the thing to know about the global making of vaccines as well as other pharmaceutical products is that we're talking about a highly integrated global market for these pieces. So you might make a bag in the United States that's used in a production line in India that also goes along with something that's made in Australia and something that's made in Germany and something that's made in South Korea. And all these pieces are needed by each of the vaccine manufacturers to make those vaccines. The challenge is right now every government has been clamping down on the export of elements. And so in Germany, they're clamping down and giving them to BioNTech. In the United States, they're clamping down and giving them to Moderna. So India has been trying very hard in the companies that are making it to get those goods into Indian factories, but they've been running into increasing problems as the U.S. has prioritized only itself.
Yeah, so I'm getting a really good picture of this highly integrated global market you're talking about. So what is the intended impact of loosening up the availability of these inputs? And how soon could we start to see the impact?
So look, this is an important move, but it's only a very short-term solution. The bigger problem is that most of the world's middle-income and low-income countries are currently depending on one or two vaccine manufacturers, which means that low- and middle-income countries around the world are not going to be able to get access to vaccines because we've only got these couple companies that are making them. If the US government really wants to get in the game, India has dozens of companies that could be making vaccines. They're not because of the monopolies that exist out there. And so right now, we're dependent on a handful of companies, and that's the real danger that we've got.
Matt Cavanaugh is an assistant professor of global health at Georgetown University. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
More news on this situation this afternoon. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said that the Biden administration is exploring requests to provide badly needed supplies of oxygen to India. Then there are the actual vaccines themselves, not just the raw materials. The White House told the AP today that it would begin sharing the AstraZeneca vaccine and that as many as 60 million doses could be available in the coming months. In recent weeks, there's been a growing push for well-off countries to donate more vaccines to countries in need. But as we hear from the world's Ilana Gordon, vaccine donation is a lot more complicated than it sounds.
The main global initiative to evenly distribute vaccines is called COVAX. But it's falling way short. COVAX so far has shipped just 50 million doses to low- and middle-income countries. It's a fraction of what they had anticipated and an even tinier fraction of what's actually needed.
We have already headed into a kind of COVID-19 vaccine apartheid with very dramatic consequences.
Dagenge Ulstein is Norway's Minister for International Development and one of the leaders in COVAX. He says a big problem is that wealthier countries have reserved millions of doses that they will never use. This kind of vaccine nationalism only helps the virus.
It is the best recipe for prolonging the pandemic. And secondly, it threatens our own populations through new mutations, and it will continue to do great damage to our own economies and jobs. And of course, it is extremely selfish.
His message is simple.
Begin to share.
Donate some of those vaccines. Follow Norway's lead. The country decided to forego buying doses it would be eligible to get through COVAX and instead donated those funds towards vaccines for lower-income countries. In recent weeks, wealthier countries have changed their tone. Stephen Morrison directs the Global Health Policy Center at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. He says when COVAX was first being set up, higher-income countries said it would be better to just give lower-income countries cash.
Well, now it's becoming apparent that doses are the problem, not cash. And so finding the doses and getting them quickly and rapidly is imperative.
At the G7 meeting in February, leaders of the UK made a big deal of the need to donate vaccines.
Make sure everybody gets the vaccines that they need.
As did Germany. French President Emmanuel Macron said countries like his should share up to 5% of their doses. He told African leaders that same week it was in everyone's interest to help.
Il continuera de tourner, de faire des variants, et vraisemblablement des variants aussi.
But despite all the talk, donations haven't made much of a dent yet.
Compared to the global supply of vaccines and the pre-purchase arrangements, it's minuscule. It's dwarfed by the pre-purchase arrangements of governments.
Anna Bezruki researches vaccine agreements and donations at the Graduate Institute in Geneva. She says as of mid-April, countries had donated about 40 million doses. China is the largest donor. And what determines which countries get these donations? It's not who needs them most.
Instead, they can be grouped based on more of these diplomatic or geopolitical considerations. Neighbors, friends, allies, hoped allies. It's much easier to sort them by those categories than by anything related to the pandemic.
Vaccine donations have been slow for other big reasons. Pharmaceutical companies are struggling to ramp up supply and fulfill contracts. And those contracts are private. They have clauses that can make donations tricky. Gyan Gandhi is with UNICEF and coordinates COVAX's vaccine supply. He says there's the added headache of working out the technical issues for making any kind of transfer.
There are mundane and operational, legal, and logistical challenges for sharing now.
Vaccines have to meet safety and regulatory standards, and it has to be clear who is liable if there's any kind of problem with the vaccine. Gandhi says it was a big deal when France announced last Friday that it was donating actual vaccines, 100,000 doses, from its own supply through COVAX.
It's an exciting test case. Of course, it's one donor country, one manufacturer, and one recipient country, but the test case demonstrates that it's feasible for each of those parties, which suggests that, you know, it should be feasible to do on a larger scale.
Still, whether that happens is a matter of political will. Stephen Morrison with the Center for Strategic and International Studies says the United States has a big role to play here. His group estimates that by summer, the U.S. will have a surplus of hundreds of millions of vaccines.
We need a diversified strategy of sharing.
But even in Norway, which is leading the push, vaccine donations have been controversial and prompted a showdown between political parties. So even in countries with a strong tradition of global solidarity and investing in global health, the pandemic is putting everyone to the test. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Across France yesterday, thousands of people took to the streets in anger. They were protesting a top court's decision to not try a man who killed his 65-year-old Jewish neighbor in 2017. The court's reasoning? The perpetrator was in a, quote, delirious state during the attack, a condition the court said aggravated by the man's consumption of cannabis. From Paris, Rebecca Rossman has more.
Ça va, on est là.
Abraham Nahum is a Tunisian Jew who has been living in the multi-ethnic Paris neighborhood of Belleville for more than 40 years. The 75-year-old retiree is what you would call a schmoozer, the kind of guy that knows a little bit about everyone in the quartier, including a 65-year-old retired doctor named Sarah Halimi.
Et vous descendez la rue, vous avez la rue, vos couleurs, c'est là où elle habitait, Madame Halimi.
He points to a street just up the road, Halimi's old residence. 4 years ago, she was fast asleep when a neighbor broke into her apartment in the middle of the night, tortured her for 20 minutes straight, then threw her off her third-floor balcony. During the attack, other neighbors say they heard the perpetrator, a then-27-year-old man named Kobili Traoré, scream Allahu Akbar, Arabic for God is great, and I killed the devil. Traoré confessed to the murder, but insisted he couldn't be tried because he was suffering from a psychotic episode after smoking a large amount of marijuana. A court agreed, and earlier this month, the decision was upheld by France's highest appeals court. Traoré is currently in a psychiatric institution, but the country's Jewish community is still in shock.
Alors on va fumer un joint et puis quoi?
So someone can just smoke a joint and then go and kill someone? Nahum was one of some 25,000 people who came to the Place Trocadéro near the Eiffel Tower on Sunday to protest the court's decision.
It's really a lack of courage from the part of the highest legal organization of our country.
Robert Egenes is the executive director of CRIF, the umbrella organization for Jews in France. Just before Sunday's protests, France's Justice Minister Éric Dupond-Moretti said he would present a bill next month to change the law so that defendants like Traoré could still be tried in cases of voluntary substance abuse. French President Emmanuel Macron has also expressed support for the change. Critics, however, say they still want justice for Sarah Halimi, which they say can only happen if her murderer goes on trial. Michel Serfati is a rabbi based in the Paris suburb of Ris-Orangis.
Il est de la responsabilité française, du gouvernement de la France, de relever ce
pari. He says it's France's responsibility to seek a fair and proper judgment of this case. And it's not just about Sarah Halimi, says Robert Egenes of the CRIF.
It's the judgment for the anti-Semitism, the Islamic anti-Semitism that has killed 12 times since 2003 in France.
Egenes points out that all 12 attackers had been motivated by radical Islam, something else the state needs to address. Though he is seeing signs of hope, he says when Halimi was killed in 2017, only around 200 people, all from the Jewish community, showed up to a local vigil. But Sunday's protests were a different scene.
I think the vision of the chief rabbi of France with all the leaders of the religious communities, Catholic, Buddhist, and Muslim community, was a very strong message.
A message that says Sarah Halimi's murder and anti-Semitism in general isn't just a Jewish problem. It's a French problem, and it's time for the state to act on it. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
An Oscar win that China is not celebrating. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Jerusalem, police have clashed with Palestinians on a nightly basis since the start of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. That's after a controversial decision by Israeli police to barricade a popular gathering spot in Jerusalem's old city, the plaza at the famous Damascus Gate. From Jerusalem, The World's Ariel Osaran has our story.
It's morning here at the Damascus Gate, and there's hardly any sign of the violent clashes that went on here last night, except for maybe the police barricades that are scattered here on the ground. Local resident Mustafa Mrakesto is on his way to the courthouse nearby. He tells me his two sons were arrested by Israeli police just the night before. 14-year-old Bashar and 16-year-old Anas were picked up on suspicion of throwing rocks and bottles at police and military forces. They were among hundreds of Palestinian teens who came out to protest the newly placed barricades in what's considered to be the town square of East Jerusalem.
It's not fair, you know, what he do with the army. If he give it for the people to sit here, it's no people fighting. And, you know, it's so bad situation for everybody, you know.
If only people could just sit and enjoy the steps of the plaza here as they usually do on Ramadan, he's saying, there wouldn't be any tension. This bad situation that Mrakesto is talking about peaked last Thursday. Just down the road from here, hundreds of nationalist Israelis marched through the streets towards Damascus Gate, looking to attack Palestinians. In this video, dozens of teenagers, some of them members of a Jewish extremist group called Lehava, are chanting death to Arabs. This came in response to recent videos circulating on TikTok showing Palestinians slapping religious Jews at random. Other videos made in response appear to show Jews assaulting Arabs. Some people I spoke with in the neighborhood say the police are only making the situation worse because they're much tougher on Palestinians than right-wing Jewish mobs. But others, including business owners in the Old City, say they just want the police to keep things under control. 23-year-old Arish Hamdan works at a clothing shop just inside the Damascus Gate.
Nighttime in Ramadan is supposed to be the time to sell and for the business to flourish. Now, I hesitate to come and open my shop after iftar because it is dangerous.
Hamdan says she blames everybody for this mess. The Jews, the Arabs, one side starts and the other reacts. This is no way to live, she says.
I think it is the police that can separate the fighters, that can separate people who are in disagreement. In my opinion, the only thing that gives me hope is a strong police force.
And one that protects both Jewish Israelis and Palestinians as well. Last night, police finally removed the barricades, allowing free movement in and around the popular Damascus Gate. Palestinians came out to celebrate. It was the calmest night in this part of the Old City since the Ramadan began. But elsewhere in the country, Palestinian militant groups in the Gaza Strip fired dozens of rockets at towns in southern Israel over the last few days, saying this was in response to the barricades placed outside the Damascus Gate. The Israeli military says it's on high alert and will respond to any further rocket attacks. For The World, I'm Ariel Osaran in Jerusalem.
And the Oscar goes to Chloe Zhao, Nomadland.
Director Bong Joon-ho there, giving out the award at last night's Academy Awards to Chloe Zhao, who made history as the first woman of color to win Best Director, and only the second woman to win the award. Her film Nomadland also took honors for Best Picture and Best Actress. The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai is here to talk about how Chloe Zhao's win is being viewed back in her home country of China. In the U.S., Chloe Zhao is being celebrated for breaking barriers, Rebecca. It's the first win by a Chinese director, correct?
Yes, it's the first major Oscar win by a Chinese person. So that should be big news here. People follow the Oscars closely every year. And Chloe Zhao was born in Beijing. She's been living in the U.S. since she was a teenager. And her acceptance speech reflected her childhood in China. She quoted this classic Chinese text, which pretty much every person here knows. You learn it in kindergarten.
人之初性本善. People at birth are inherently good. And those six letters had such a great impact on me when I was a kid, and I still truly believe them today.
But this year, nobody in China could watch the Oscars because they were banned. That's for two reasons. One, There was a Hong Kong democracy protest documentary that was up for an award, and the other is Chloe Zhao.
So what is it about Chloe Zhao that got the Oscar broadcast banned in China?
Up until earlier this year, she was pretty much unknown here. Her films haven't been shown in theaters, but when she started winning awards, state media got all excited. They called her the pride of China. She was like a trending topic on Weibo and WeChat. There were plans for a theater release of Nomadland. But then people started searching around on the internet and found an interview from almost 10 years ago where she made some disparaging comments about China, where she grew up. And she called China a place full of lies. And she said when she left China, she had to almost unlearn things. And that's when the Oscars were banned.
So with this ban on the Oscars broadcast in China, were Chinese even aware that Chloe Zhao had won?
Yes, there was very muted coverage. But people were posting messages on Weibo and WeChat with congratulations. There was clearly pride in her winning. But then within just a few hours, all those links didn't work anymore. And if you searched for her name or the name of the movie, you'd just come up empty, as if nothing had happened. So several people even posted online that they had tried to post something about her and they couldn't even send out the post. So there is information there, but it's just nothing what you would expect from such a groundbreaking win.
China, let's remember, is the biggest film market in the world. What kind of larger impact will this have on which Hollywood films get shown in China?
Every year, the government has a quota of how many foreign films can be shown here. Zhao's next film is The Eternals, which is a Marvel superhero film, and that's set for release in November. And Marvel is huge here. So maybe the filmmakers were hoping that a Chinese director would be a plus, but now she seems to be a risk instead. So it's going to be really interesting to see whether this ban on Chloe Zhao will extend to the Marvel film.
The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai checking in with us on how China has been responding or not to the win by Chloe Zhao at the Academy Awards for Best Director. Rebecca, thank you very much.
Thank you.
One more Oscar note, something we in radio were especially intrigued by, the winner for Best Sound. The Sound of Metal tells the story of a drummer who loses his hearing. It stars British actor Riz Ahmed.
What are you saying?
I can't hear you. I can't f***ing hear you. Do you understand me? I can't. I'm f***ing deaf.
Ahmed's character learns that listening isn't something we do only with our ears. It is a whole body thing. Researchers for the film studied how we hear through our bodies, our breathing, even hearing through our organs. The crew recorded sounds inside actor Riz Ahmed's mouth and used special contact microphones that, instead of registering what we hear, pick up the body's internal vibrations, essentially recording what we feel. The sound crew for The Sound of Metal worked across international borders. It included people from Venezuela and Mexico, with editing done in and around Mexico City. You're with the world. President Biden calls the killing of Armenians a genocide.
I hope that my children, they will see the day when Turkey comes to terms with the genocide.
People of Armenian descent react, as do Turks.
Calling it as a genocide is ridiculing the Turkish nation, making them look like monsters.
The use of a consequential word ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Mexico is really struggling with the coronavirus. It's got the third highest number of COVID-19 deaths in the world after the U.S. and Brazil. The Mexican government has also been slow to ramp up vaccinations for pretty much everyone. That even includes medical workers who say they're being overlooked. The World's Jorge Valencia in Mexico City has been speaking with doctors who are making a list of frontline workers who have yet to get a shot.
The list includes many general practitioners, like Dr. Maria Jose Diaz.
Today, I've seen 3 COVID patients. Today.
Diaz runs her own family practice near downtown Mexico City. On this particular day, her patients came in with a sore throat, diarrhea, fever.
Yes, I give them a rapid test, and now they are in their homes, and they are going to start the treatment.
Diaz had closer practice for a few months at the beginning of the pandemic.
And then I realized that I couldn't live like that because I need the money. So I opened again my practice, and I realized that every patient is a suspicious patient.
So like any other healthcare provider, she wears N95 masks and goggles. And when vaccines started arriving, she waited. Then she waited some more and some more after that.
And then in the 1st of April, I remember perfect the date, I realized that my government didn't have any interest in put a vaccine in doctors that were not in the public service.
The Mexican government has skipped over tens of thousands of healthcare workers for a vaccine. It's not just doctors, by the way. It's nurses, technicians, office assistants, and cleaning staff. And that's because the government has officially prioritized only workers from public hospitals. On April 1st, hundreds of private practice providers stood outside of the Naval Academy in Mexico City, where the government stores vaccines. This government official tells the crowd there will be no doses for private healthcare workers. We want the vaccine, they respond. The group dispersed after several hours. Dr. Malaquias López Cervantes is a former official at the Mexican Health Ministry and now teaches public health at the National Autonomous University of Mexico.
That's profoundly unfair and should not happen.
López Cervantes explains the government has designated public hospitals as the official COVID treatment facilities. But those hospitals were overwhelmed even before the pandemic, so private healthcare providers have also become important frontline workers. López Cervantes says Mexican political leaders are disregarding recommendations from the World Health Organization and their own scientists.
It's pretty disorganized. What we have in Mexico is not a plan for vaccination, but just a collection of ideas that come out of political convenience.
In other words, the government is winging it. So one group of doctors started making the list of medical workers waiting for a vaccine. Dr. David Berrones is an ophthalmologist in San Luis Potosí.
We did a Google form where we ask name, professional number of our degree, the license ID, our email, and all sort of things that we are aiming to count.
Berrones says more than 31,000 healthcare providers are on the list. But he says he thinks that's only a fraction of the real figure. He says in some cases, doctors are traveling to the United States where anyone over the age of 16 can now get a dose.
Lots. I can tell you that at least I know 20, 30 people who has done it.
But not everyone can fly to another country, Berrones says. Dr. Maria Jose Diaz and her office assistant in Mexico City can't either. They're both younger than 40, which by government rules means they won't be able to get vaccinated at least until the end of the year.
Today, I am angry. I'm no longer sad. Today, I'm angry.
Diaz says she believes the government skipped over them for political reasons. Mexico will hold congressional elections this June, and Diaz says President Andrés Manuel López Obrador wants to make a show at a beginning vaccinations for the next priority group, the elderly. So Diaz and other private medical workers are taking part in civil disobedience.
I have to confess that I've been closing streets. I've been closing streets with many of my colleagues, so people realize that this problem exists.
Diaz says she will keep turning to the streets until the government gives them the protection they need to do their job. For the World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
This weekend, President Biden used the word genocide. It's not something a head of state does lightly. Biden issued this statement on Saturday. The American people honor all those Armenians who perished in the genocide that began 106 years ago today. And with that, Biden became the first U.S. president to officially recognize as genocide the massacre of Armenians living under Ottoman rule. Jason Sahigian is the executive director of the Armenian Museum of America, just down the road from us in Watertown, Massachusetts. Jason, how important was it that President Biden used this word, genocide?
Well, you know, most Armenians around the world, including us, including myself, we've all had some direct contact or been impacted by the genocide. My grandparents were orphaned by the genocide. It affects Armenians everywhere.
Earlier on Saturday, President Biden spoke with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The U.S.-Turkey relationship is complicated, of course, by geopolitics, and the White House was careful not to mention Turkey by name in the genocide statement. Biden used the term Ottoman. Those were the rulers back then. Did Armenians in the diaspora, did you notice the absence of calling out Turkey by name?
It was definitely noticed. You know, there was a lot of discussion of it over the last couple of days. On the other hand, you know, Turkey wasn't mentioned, but they are the inheritors of the Ottoman Empire of Ottoman Turkey.
So you're the executive director of the Armenian Museum of America. You know this history. What is your own story, Jason?
Well, my grandparents were survivors of the Armenian Genocide, and they came to America as orphans when they were young. And they joined kind of a long line of Armenian immigrants to New England. Many of them settled in Worcester, where I'm from. There were factories in Worcester where Armenians worked. And they also came to Watertown, where our museum is located. There was a factory there where a lot of Armenians worked. So it was kind of this story of, you know, immigration of the survivors to America and many countries of the world that took in the survivors who were orphaned. It's really a story of survival and resilience.
So for you, as a descendant of Armenians, what does this genocide statement mean to you and also to your parents?
Well, I mean, I think for Armenians, you know, there's still a lot of unresolved issues around this genocide. I think the fact that it happened and there were no consequences for it for Turkey. So I think them having that sort of sense of impunity, it leads to ongoing cases of mass violence. Even recently, in September, the Republic of Artsakh, where Armenians were living, was attacked by Azerbaijan, and that was with the open support of the Turkish military. So we're still seeing cases of ethnic cleansing and cultural erasure that's happening even today.
Jason, I don't know if you have kids, but how would you tell this story to the next generation of Armenian Americans?
Well, yeah, so I have two children, and you know, they're slowly learning about what happened. Armenians have been resilient, creative people, successful, and I hope that, you know, my children continue to be involved in the community, be involved in Armenia, and hopefully, you know, they will see the day when Turkey comes to terms with the genocide and is willing to have more peaceful relations with Armenia.
Jason Sahigian is the executive director of the Armenian Museum of America in Watertown, Massachusetts, speaking with us about reaction to President Biden's recognition of the Armenian genocide on Saturday. Jason, good to have you with us today. Thank you for your thoughts.
Thank you so much, Marco.
This evening in Turkey, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan shot back at Biden's weekend announcement,
en başından beri Ermeni çevrelerin,
calling Biden's words unfounded and unjust. Turkey does not recognize the killing and deportation of Armenian civilians during World War I as genocide. Turkey summoned the U.S. ambassador to protest the use of the word. There is a lot at stake here. Turkey has been a key NATO ally since 1952. Duri Buscarin reports now on how this moment could affect future U.S.-Turkish relations.
Here, in the country established after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, the use of the word genocide carries fireworks.
Şimdi Ermeni lobisine de bir dikkat çekmek lazım.
Turkish media commentators took to the airwaves to voice their anger, laying the blame on a lobbying effort by the Armenian diaspora and U.S. media outlets.
Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post.
Why doesn't the U.S. recognize its own genocide of the Native Americans, some asked. Ibrahim Kalin, Turkey's presidential spokesman, told Al Jazeera that the U.S. has their facts wrong about World War I.
There were mutual killing and atrocities from all sides. The Russians, the British, and many others were involved in those killings and uprisings. This statement by the U.S. president politicizes historical facts for narrow political gains, and this is really unfortunate.
Even before President Biden's statement acknowledging the genocide on Saturday, the value of Turkey's national currency, the lira, dipped.
They just believe that just calling it as a genocide is ridiculing the Turkish nation, just making them look like monsters.
Ragip Soylu is the Turkey correspondent for the Middle East Eye. World War I and its aftermath is the foundation story for modern-day Turkey. Of course people take it personally, he says. These are Turkey's forefathers we're talking about.
But they also think that, you know, it wasn't a genocide. It was just a battle on the ground that was going on two communities. And a lot of Turkish civilians were also killed. And they also think that, you know, Armenians were the first who attacked the Turks as well. That's the narrative.
Officially, Turkey's government doesn't deny that the Ottoman Empire killed and deported hundreds of thousands of Armenian civilians to the Syrian desert more than 100 years ago. But they claim that Ottoman troops were fighting Armenian rebels, who were collaborating with the invading Russian army. James Helicki is a historian whose work focuses on the Armenian genocide and its discourse. He says Turkey's claims are largely rebutted by scholarly research and firsthand accounts of the time.
The U.S. ambassador at the time, Henry Morgenthau, he described the Ottoman actions very clearly as, and this is a quote, a campaign of race extermination. And I think it's about as close, pretty close as you can get to the definition of genocide.
The term genocide didn't exist until 30 years later, after the Holocaust. By this time, Turkey was a strategic ally in the Cold War against the Soviet Union. Helicki says that the U.S. so valued its relationship with Turkey that presidents decided not to use the word to describe what happened to Armenians decades before, despite increasing calls to do so from Armenian Americans and human rights groups.
What we really see is cold pragmatism. There was, frankly, interest in making sure that this issue didn't upset U.S.-Turkish relations and the alliance that came into being during the Cold War.
This weekend, before Biden made his statement, he made a phone call to Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, his first as a sitting president.
Now we are at the point that, you know, like Biden only calls Erdogan because he wants them to learn the news that he's going to recognize the Armenian genocide. So that's the state of the relations between the two countries.
Ragıp Soylu, the journalist, points out that despite forceful public statements, Turkey's government chose not to retaliate after Biden's announcement. They did not revoke the U.S. right to use its airbase in the Turkish town of Incirlik. They did not withdraw diplomats from Washington.
The most important part is that Turkey doesn't have any chips anymore to go after America. I mean, you have like a ruined economy, and then you don't want to have another crisis with the United States because it would really, you know, harm your markets and economy, and you cannot afford that. It's literally they cannot afford it.
To him, this suggests that the effect on U.S.-Turkey relations going forward could be minimal. There's not much more damage that can be done. For the world, I'm Derry Biscarin.
In Myanmar, after nearly 3 months of horrific violence, the country's top general now says he will, quote, immediately stop the killing. Since a military coup on the 1st of February, police and army troops in Myanmar have killed something like 750 civilians there. General Min Aung Hlaing agreed to find a peaceful solution on Saturday when he met with Southeast Asian presidents and prime ministers. The World's Patrick Nguyen in neighboring Bangkok joins us to explain whether this is a breakthrough or something else. Could this be, Patrick, what so many people are waiting for, an end to the violent crackdown?
Well, that would be really great, Marco. Unfortunately, there's just so many reasons to be skeptical. This general, Min Aung Hlaing, is just not the type of person whose word is very credible. I mean, his troops have been shooting women and children. They have launched mortars, explosive shells into crowded neighborhoods, all to suppress a mass uprising, this uprising of people who are resisting the army's takeover of the country. And, you know, they feel that Myanmar has been under bleak army rule for much of its history. Only in the last 10 years did the country move in a brighter direction, holding elections. And now this general is dragging them back in the dark. So he is widely disliked. He will face more resistance on the street. And it's just hard to believe he will all of a sudden sit back and tolerate it and not use violence against people.
The development does seem kind of surprising. Political leaders in Southeast Asia have long preached the idea of non-intervention. Why do you think they're now calling for an end to the killing in Myanmar? And why do you think the general publicly agreed to do that?
Yeah, they would certainly like to see an end to the killing. As for why the general, Min Aung Hlaing, would agree to this, I mean, he may feel he needs to do something to offset all the international condemnation that he's feeling. He did make this agreement at that big ASEAN meeting on Saturday. So you've got Indonesia, Vietnam, Thailand, the Philippines, all the major countries in the region are there. And, you know, if he's going to negotiate or play nice with any foreign countries, he'd probably rather do it with his neighbors as opposed to the UN or the EU or the US, where many officials think very poorly of him. But Marco, like even Myanmar's neighbors, I mean, they've been reluctant to say that he's now the legit leader of the country just because he staged a coup. He's really quite a radioactive presence, even in Southeast Asian countries. I mean, some of the leaders of these countries are also running undemocratic regimes. Even they seem leery of him. And bottom line, if he breaks his word and slaughters more civilians, as he's been doing, there's nothing much they can do to punish him.
Patrick, you've been following the Myanmar story closely since the coup there on February 1st. How much of an impact do you think these pronouncements over the weekend will actually have inside Myanmar?
If we want to be optimistic, maybe in the short term, hopefully the troops will stop terrorizing the population. The other factor is General Min Aung Hlaing did just agree to let foreign envoys come in. That's new. Foreign envoys who will meet with all sides and start dialogue with, quote, all sides. That would almost have to mean the elected government that he wiped out with his coup. But they're now in hiding or locked up. Aung San Suu Kyi, the elected leader, she is detained, and I've been told by one of her confidants that she may be in such isolation she doesn't even know what's happening. So I suppose there's a chance that they would be able to come out of hiding or prison and talk, but it is hard to imagine the military, after doing all this, exacting all this violence, just returning to the barracks like nothing happened. On the other hand, they are now so despised by the people to govern the country effectively, so there's no easy solutions on the horizon.
Patrick Nguyen, based in Bangkok, is the world's Southeast Asia correspondent. Patrick, thanks as always.
Thanks, Marco.
During the pandemic, some people considered health measures restrictions on personal freedoms, when masks or not hugging are really about keeping ourselves and those around us safe. The pandemic has led, however, to a decrease globally in religious freedom. That's according to a newly released annual report by an independent commission in Washington. And yet, a longstanding focus of U.S. foreign policy has been protecting religious freedom. As the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, even that has not been immune from partisanship.
It's not all bad news when it comes to religious freedom around the world. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, or USIRF, highlighted some bright spots. Uzbekistan ended the practice of raiding religious minority communities. Sudan repealed laws that had been used to punish women who acted in ways deemed improper. USIRF recommended that it, Bahrain, and the Central African Republic be removed from a special watch list.
That is a major step.
But USIRF Commissioner Reverend Frederick Davey says in other countries, divides deepened, persecution intensified, and marginalized religious communities were harassed for allegedly spreading the virus. Some governments took advantage of the coronavirus pandemic to restrict religious rights.
They used it as a pretext for targeting particular religions.
Those countries include Cambodia, Pakistan, and also India, which USIRF says has instituted national policies that violate religious freedoms. For the second year, it recommended that India be named a country of particular concern. But that's something the Trump administration rejected, and the State Department still has not done. And that points to an inherent contradiction in U.S. policy on religious freedom. Jeffrey Haynes is an emeritus professor of politics at London Metropolitan University.
America does tend to side with bad guys sometimes that practice what I would see as bad religious freedom policies.
Still, Haynes says the U.S. is the only country that makes protecting religious rights a central part of its foreign policy.
No other country has anything like the apparatus that the U.S. has.
That apparatus was created by the 1998 International Religious Freedom Act under President Bill Clinton. It instituted a U.S. ambassador at large for religious freedom and made two bodies that each issue annual reports, one inside the State Department, the Office of International Religious Freedom, and USIRF, an independent bipartisan commission appointed by the president and congressional leaders.
And in my observation over the years, there's been this argument and tension between the two reports, like, no, no, my report's the best. And no, actually, ours is.
Sean Casey directs Georgetown University's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. During the Obama administration, he led a newly created Office of Religious and Global Affairs within the State Department.
In the meantime, in the over 20 years of the existence of this architecture, religious persecution has gotten worse around the world. And it seems like the question of what policies might actually turn that trend around gets lost in the competition between the two political parties.
The Trump administration closed the office Casey led, and Undersecretary of State Mike Pompeo started yet another commission to study international religious freedom. Critics say it was created to prioritize a certain view of religious liberty while overlooking other priorities like reproductive and LGBTQ rights. Biden's Secretary of State Antony Blinken rejected the Trump approach last month.
Past unbalanced statements that suggest such a hierarchy, including those offered by a recently disbanded State Department Advisory Committee, do not represent a guiding document for this administration.
Still, the State Department isn't discarding everything the Trump administration did. It sent me a statement that says it will continue participating in two Pompeo creations. One is the annual Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom. That's a gathering of world leaders to discuss religious persecution. The second is the International Religious Freedom or Belief Alliance, a network of 32 countries that have committed to protect religious freedom. But some of those nations have a mixed record on the issue. USERF Commissioner Frederick Davey says the U.S. will need all its resources to confront what might be the most troubling threat to religious freedom— the Chinese government.
It's going to take a worldwide response to continue to address this and push for change.
The USERF report points to the Chinese government's internal oppression of religious minorities and its efforts to exert influence beyond its borders. It recommends the Biden administration boycott the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing. The Chinese government has already placed sanctions on some USERF members in response to their criticism. For the world, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Finally today, we go to the mat, the floor mats in Switzerland, that is, where gymnasts this weekend took a stand at the European Championships against sexualization in their sport. German teammates Elizabeth Seitz, Sarah Voss, and Kim Bui tumbled and flipped with precision in unitards that went down to their ankles instead of the more common leotards that stop at the hip. Gymnast Sarah Voss described the decision as a project close to the hearts of their team and told German public broadcaster SWR that they've been talking about doing this for about a year.
Wir haben uns schon vor einem Jahr circa Gedanken gemacht bezüglich des langen Anzuges.
Voss said she and her teammates have been afraid of their leotards slipping as they tumble and spin through the air. She said as they grew older and went through puberty, they also felt less and less comfortable in the shorter suits. Elizabeth Seitz said everyone already trains in full body outfits. They wondered why they don't do the same during competition.
Und ich sag mal, da gibt's, wird es sehr, sehr viele geben, die, wenn sie einen Langbeinanzug anhaben.
Seitz said that she and many other gymnasts have even had to adjust their routines to make sure their leotards stay in place. She hopes more gymnasts will wear these longer uniforms, if they want to, that is. Sarah Voss said they just want to encourage everyone to stand up for themselves. And we're not just talking competition togs here. The world of international gymnastics has been rocked by sexual assault allegations over the past few years. Some athletes say they'll advocate for change on the world stage at the Tokyo Olympics this summer. U.S. Olympian Simone Biles said last week she wants to use her spotlight to keep pushing for change and give survivors of abuse a voice. Today on the show, we went from the COVID crisis in India to the activist message embedded in a gymnast uniform. That's why you listen to The World, to get the full scope of the globe. Stay on top of what we're following. Our newsletter, Top of the World, brings the headlines to your inbox Monday through Friday. Sign up on our website. That's theworld.org/newsletters. And that is our show today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We're online 24/7 at theworld.org. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow.